Hello there, this is John Hindhoff, and we're out and about again, and I haven't actually come too far away from home base at Hindhoff Towers, down to Cranfield University.
The inside stories on the teams, suppliers and drivers. This is Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
I'm delighted to say that Clive Temple has invited me down to have a little look around the facilities. We've already moved inside one of the buildings because we're going to get straight into some of the hardware here. But Clive, give me a little bit of a taster of what's going on generally at Cranfield and a little bit of the history, because history is something there is plenty of here.
Yeah, that's correct, John. I've been here actually 16 years myself, and always been very interested in motorsport and recognised that Cranfield had a real pedigree where motorsport was concerned in terms of its infrastructure, work that it did with motorsport teams. I mean, back in the 1980s, I recall seeing Lotus Formula One cars running up and down on our runway and then getting a sense that we had wind tunnels here. And when I came back to Cranfield in the 1990s, I got myself into a position with one of my colleagues where we developed a postgraduate program for developing future motorsport engineers who had management capability. And we did that working with a steering committee that was then chaired by Jackie Stewart. And we developed very close ties through that body with many teams, not just in Formula One, but also right the way across the spectrum, touring cars. We had RML on board. And we got involved with teams running Le Mans prototypes. And so that was very useful for me because I have a strong interest in endurance racing. And we've been developing, as I say, engineers with management ability. But critically, we have been using the infrastructure that we have within the university. That includes Cranfield Impact Centre, CIC, where we do a lot of the FIA approvals for both Formula One, but also for LMP cars. The wind tunnels that we have here, we've got expertise where coatings technology is concerned, and that of course is of interest to people with the change in the regulations for 2014. And then we've got some other interesting tricks and toys, etc. And we're going to have a look at one of those very shortly, which is on the simulation side. But later on, I'm going to show you something else as well, where we're very much at the forefront of off-road development.
Well, the link between motorsport and aerospace has always been keen, and perhaps in the early years it was even more prevalent than it is now. And you mentioned the airfield, and the history of this place goes way back into the late 1930s. And you've brought me to see Graham Campion, the business development manager over here, in an old, what looks to me, an old World War II aircraft hangar, Graham. So, I mean, first of all, how cool is it coming to work every morning? I suppose it's not too difficult to get motivated.
No, it's very cool. We carry out a large range of work here. Cranfield Motorsport Simulation is a division of Cranfield Aerospace, and we have the approvals to actually design, manufacture and fly both manned and unmanned aircraft, which is pretty unique. The capability we have in terms of aerospace is equal to, and in some cases greater than, that of BAE Systems, MBDA, etc. But one of the products that we've had for many years, which is what we've carried over to our motorsport industry, is the motion cueing seat, or the sustained G seat. Now, what we've done is provided sustained G cueing, and the main word here is the sustained, rather than just the onset cues, for fast jet and helicopter pilots. This has happened for probably 35 years now. We've also been involved with motorsport. As Clive said, the Lotuses whizzing up and down the runway would have had our active suspension system, which we fitted originally with Nigel Mansell with a JPS Lotus, and more recently with Aaron Senna, Mika Hakkinen, Julian Bailey, etc., Panis for the Camel Lotus race teams. So we transferred our technology that we'd used for all these years for the fast jet and helicopter over to motorsport some years ago. We have systems with Formula One teams. We already have systems with NASCAR teams out in the States. We've created a huge interest in the product. Both the media and race drivers have said that obviously there are simulators in motorsport, but our product is what all of those products are missing. They only provide the onset cue, not sustained cue.
Yeah, now the key word that you keep seeing there is sustained cue. Mm-hmm. Now, you can get fairly sophisticated, almost home systems now, if you've got 20 or 30 grand to burn down in your playroom and your basement. But again, the range of movement there is limited. And the problem that most people will find, and what you're talking about here, Graham, is that you get that initial movement, but then when it's gone so far, it's gone to the limit of its movement. There's nothing more to give. And of course, in the real world, that doesn't happen. You can hold a car sideways, and that's the problem with a lot of systems. They can't replicate that.
Yeah, no, that's very true. The motorsport industry, when particularly in the Formula One, when they realised that track time, lap time and testing was going to be reduced, they looked at various industries to see what was out there commercially. Mm-hmm. And they adopted the 6DOF platform, the 6 degrees of freedom platform, from the civil aerospace industry. Now, the word there is civil. You've got 747, 737 simulators. They're not a dynamic aircraft. Mm. They're designed to have a roll angle of 30, 35 degrees, 40 degrees, very slow, cumbersome moving aircraft. Now, the motorsport then adopted that technology as a starting point, and yes, then dramatically and very quickly realised that it wasn't quite the product they were looking for. So people do use platforms still, but they aren't as dynamic as they should be, and they don't provide the sustained GQing. The product that we have focuses around the interface between the vehicle itself, the car, the cockpit, the seat, and the driver. So as you correctly said earlier, the 6DOF platform, or a vehicle actuator frame, which is what we have, provides the onset cue. So it stimulates the vestibular system, which is the mechanism that recognises self-motion behind the ear. And then you're totally dependent on the, or reliant on the visual system, mm-hmm, to give you the cue. So you would have an onset cue, you'd have an initial motion, and then the visual system takes over. Now, what our system does, not only does it provide the onset cue, which is the initial movement of the seat, it also provides sustained GQing via pneumatic cells placed around the seat itself. Ah. So they are actually between the driver and the seat. Going back to what you were just saying, that you can actually get a car sliding, you can feel that slide through the seat. Wow. As you get into the car, you accelerate away, the first thing you're going to feel is if you're being pushed back into the car. Now, what we do is to inflate pneumatic cells behind the back, which gives you the acceleration cue. Not enough to move the driver. We're talking about somatic cueing, yeah, here, which is skin pressure, so changes in skin pressure. All the demands come from the vehicle model itself, so everything that we do is totally scaled to the demands from the vehicle model. So the acceleration, you talked about other devices that move you around quite cheaply in people's garages. Yeah. They, to me, are a fairground ride. What we do is to scale everything. It's 30 years worth of technology in the algorithms that we use to convert the demands into displacement. So the guy's accelerating now. As he blips the gears, as he changes gears, you're going to get a very rapid deceleration periodically. Yeah. So you feel that come through the back as well, and then it maintains the acceleration again. Going into the corner, you would experience pressure on your shoulders, your ribs, your hips and your thighs. Now, as you turn in and pull 1, 2, 3 G, the pressure that we apply is proportional to those G levels. If you're maintaining a 3 G demand around a 3 G bend, the pressure will retain from that. In going back to what you were saying about the car sliding, in simplistic terms, whilst the car has traction, you, the driver, are being forced against the side of the seat, side of the car. So you are feeling pressure there. Again, in simplistic, if you lose the traction, you are then moving within the car. Mm-hmm. So periodically, or very quickly, you lose the pressure that you're, mm-hmm, experiencing. So we get into a situation now where when the car starts to lose grip, we lose the pressure that he's experiencing through the pneumatic cells. Okay, and very quickly, within 15 to 20 milliseconds, we can take that pressure away. Wow. We can also bring it back. So as the guy then contains the slide, gets grip back, he's going to feel pressure again. by getting into the situation where you feel the pressure coming off and going off, you can actually control the skid.
I'm always told by my wife, who's the bare brains of our operation, no one's going to argue with that comment right here, feature, function, benefit, right? Yeah. So you've told me the feature and the function.
Yeah.
What is the end result? Why is it better to do it this way? Because clearly it's a hell of a lot of technology. I'm standing in a room, by the way, dear listener, that has a 180-degree pretty much panoramic screen around a racing car, single-seater racing car cockpit. The front wheels are not on the cockpit. They're presented to you as a visual cue on the front. But everything else, including a very, very complex-looking steering wheel, is there. So tell me, feature, function, benefit. Why, Graham, is it better to do it this way? And what does anyone who uses this apparatus get out of it that they won't get elsewhere?
Yeah, the whole thing about simulation is immersion and the level of immersion. Now, I think anybody who knows anything about simulation will openly admit there is 60-65% of the simulation is the visual system. Mm-hmm. Now, what you can do by adding additional cues is to increase the level of immersion up to, obviously, reality, 100%. So by bringing in audio cues, bringing in motion cues, etc., then you can add to that value. Now, what we do with our system is to apply the feeling of G that the driver actually experiences in whilst driving. In my opinion, if you have a fixed-base simulator and the visual system, and you're trying to bring on a young driver from karting to open wheel series, then he may as well sit on his couch at home and do track recognition on a PlayStation, Sony PlayStation.
Because they are that good nowadays. I mean, the representation of tracks nowadays, yeah, and the mapping that these guys do down to fractions of a millimetre, yeah, in terms of that visual cue, that's actually pretty damn good.
Yeah, but the problem with that is he is only reliant on the visual cue. He is driving a visual system. He may as well sit on his couch at home and do that. Mm. Now, what we do is to bring the added realism to the driving experience. As I mentioned earlier, we can get the guy controlling the skid of the car. He can feel what the car is doing. If it's a young guy who's going to a circuit for the first time, he can come here, he can learn the circuit, track familiarization. But at the same time, he can see how the car reacts to that circuit. So he's the
a specific car at that point.
Yes, yeah. What we can do, we use something called R Factor, which is a commercial product that has been adopted by the industry. So what we can do is to go into the background of that software, and we can change the parameters. So we can take if the driver brings over his engineering data, we can set that car very, very close to the feel of his car. So we can set all the parameters, whether it's the wishbone, suspension settings, the aerodynamics, etc., etc. So the guy, all intents and purposes, is driving his own car. All the circuits that we have checked out by our technical partners over at GPR, at Silverstone, and they authenticate the track data, etc., so that the thing is correct. So when the guy is actually driving now, not only is he just learning the layout of the circuit, he's actually learning the braking points, the turning points, how to drive the car around that circuit. What happens when you hit the curb? You know, is the curb, can you clip the curb on this occasion, or is it going to send you airborne? All that data comes back through the simulator.
And it's way better doing that in virtual reality than in real life. I can testify to that.
Yeah. We've had experiences and we've had feedback from guys who have been here where they've been on practice days, and normally the third session of a practice day, they're still just about learning the circuit. Whereas they've done all that work here, they know the circuit, they know the turning points, they know the braking points, and then when they get to the circuit, they can concentrate on their racing lines and just refining what they've learned at Cranfield.
Now, Cranfield, as we said, is an academic institute, but this is very much another commercial arm that Cranfield has running exactly in parallel, which I think puts it in a very interesting and possibly a unique position. What benefit do students here get from having this kind of a setup here, and how does that prepare them for a future life in work?
The Cranfield Motorsport Simulation is a limited company, as you correctly say, but we work very closely with the university. We work very closely with Clive Temple and his group. His students, when they first come here, when they arrive here, they come over, they each have a chance to drive the simulator. We talk to them about the effects of hardware in loop, so we can change through our settings, we can change the aero effect, we can change the downforce, we can change the brake balances, the bias between the front and rear wheels. So the guys actually get an experience of how an engineering input can change the handling of the car, affect the handling of the car.
And we're not trying to turn out racing drivers here, but in terms of putting that experience there into the real world without having to take a car out on the track and risk several hundred thousand pounds worth of equipment and show how it can be done wrong as well as it can be done right, presumably.
Yeah, we believe here that it's just as important for an engineer who would not normally have access to driving a vehicle to use the simulator. So he can understand whether it's the design engineer, whether the guy's a mechanic, or whether he's just, you know, a managerial position. He can understand what tweaks to the design of the wishbone, design of the chassis, etc., and how that affects the driving capability of the vehicle.
Presumably, though, the add-on, the spin-off from that, is that because so many people use similar, if not identical, simulators in motorsport nowadays, there is also a skill to be learned about running and getting the best out of simulation time.
Yeah, sure. The obviously, the main thing is that the guy, the driver, actually knows the circuit. That's the main element of it. But there is also, to maximise the simulation time within our system here, we can save the settings of the driver's car. So the next time he comes up, we can download all his information, his lap time, all the settings he had previously of the car, and everything would be ready for him there. So you can utilise and maximise the amount of time you spend here. We also have available to us certain drivers who act as driver coaches, one of them being Nicholas Hamilton, who's just joined us on board. He's actually doing a session here tomorrow with a young karting guy who's an associate driver of the university, and Nick's coming up to coach him in the open wheel stuff.
And engineers, can they learn from this as well, do you think?
Certainly. With the engineers, you know, they can drive the simulator and they can see what effect changes of hardware within the model, the vehicle model, has on the driving or the drivability of the car. So it's a very good tool for them to learn what, you know, consequences of changing hardware does to the actual handling of the vehicle.
Now, I don't want you to give me a price list, but in terms of value for money, taking a car out onto a track and come and doing a session here, what are we? Nothing in motorsport is cheap, but some things are better value than others, yeah. He says diplomatically. What are we talking about in terms of investment here, in terms of what bang for your buck you would get if you were coming here on a commercial basis as a team or a driver?
Yeah, there's various elements, obviously. We can package it. The whole of our main product is the Sustain GQ-INC, which is patent protected. That's our main product here. And the what you described earlier in the interview is somewhere around 85K for what you see here. So it's the three projectors, the wraparound screen, a raised tub, steering loader, steering wheel, and the Sustain GQ-INC element of that. Or you could use either our commercial facility over at GPR, which you have a race coach included for the price of £150 an hour, or over at Cranfield here at the university, the students and associates of the university, we charge £85 for outsiders, we charge £100 an hour. We're cheaper here just because we are not quite in the luxurious position of GPR. You know, at Silverstone we are in a aircraft hangar at the university. So.
Okay. Can we see it working?
Certainly can. Would you like to drive, or shall I?
That's a silly question. If I can get in it, I'm going to have a drive. Stay with us, dear listener. We're at Cranfield University on another day out here for Midweek Motorsport.
The inside stories on the teams, suppliers and drivers. This is Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
Well, I've had a couple of little practices, and now this one's for real. Heading down the field, start me flying lap, get the braking point right. Turn in. Oh, a little bit of a slide, feather on the throttle, and onto the start finish straight of the new Silverstone circuit. Quite fitting into the cockpit here, so I've got my hand on the top of the steering wheel as we come to the new first corner. Down one gear for the right hander. Back on the throttle, settle the car, then just a little lift, and now into the complex. Get ready to go. Down the gears, into third. Squirt the power. Oops, nearly lost the back end. Now turn into the hairpin. I'm in the wrong gear. Down one more, now on the Wellington Straight. First place, have a breather. Let's head down towards Brooklyn to get the braking point right for this and feel the grip on the front end. Here we go. And brake. Turn in. Little blast of the throttle to straighten the car up. And now it's wait, patience. Unwind the lock and on the power, and I'm being pushed back into the seat as I'm grabbing the gears across the all-star finish line. Heading towards Copse, should be flat in top, but I'm not that brave. Straight back on the power. Oh, on the curve, just about held that. Heading towards Beckett. In here, completely flat. Oh, that was a chicken lift there. Through the left. Down one more, in the right, and now opening up onto the hanger straight. It's another chance to get a breather here. I'm pretty good on the hanger straight. The straights is not the bits that bother me. Heading up the hill towards Stormwick. Get a little bit on the rise. Down from 7th to 4th. Use all the run and a bit of the curb. Now you're diving downfield. Look for the pit entrance on the right-hand side. Brick! Front end just doesn't want to turn in there. You've got to be so careful. And out onto the start-finish straight. Snatch another gear. And that's a lap of Silverstone without even leaving Cranfield.
Well, clearly not the fastest lap of the new Silverstone Grand Prix circuit ever, but I've got out rather like a damp rag. There's more laundry and ironing to do when I get home. Graham, I've got to say that is very, very impressive. It's not very often I get to drive a real single-seater, but I have done it, and I've got the same marks on my elbows that I normally get from doing that, because I'm not the most sylph-like. What I would say about the advantages about what I've just experienced is that the motion is much more realistic than I'm used to. I've often found, I'm a bit cynical about these things, I'll be honest, and I've often found the motion intrusive. It's not that at all. It is adding to the experience and not making me think, oh, I'm being moved around. And I guess that's exactly what you're trying to achieve.
Yes, it is, exactly. We've worked very hard, as I say, with the fast jet and helicopter stuff to get there. And when we felt we were ready and had the experience on that, then we moved forward with the motorsport. But with the six-stoff platforms, as we spoke about earlier, the movement is artificial. You know, in a race car, in a Formula One car, you're looking at probably 2 to 3 degrees nose down under braking, mm-hmm. and 5 to 6 degrees, including hitting a curb in roll. And, you know, a motion platform is moving you around all over the place, which isn't realistic.
Mm. The other thing I found about that, all of the thing is, getting the motion right is only part of what's going on. All of the feedback I was getting from the pedals, particularly from the steering, when I was leaving my braking super late and feeling the steering go light and then waiting for the grip to come back on the front wheels, that to me was probably as impressive as what I was feeling in the motion.
Yeah, okay, we've worked very hard. We have a steering loader system there, which, again, is very realistic. We work all the parameters of the steering, of the pedals, of the seats, etc., can be changed to suit individual drivers. Mm. So the stiffness of the brake, the amount of travel of the brake, etc., the whole system is tunable. And, as you say, we would like to think it's very realistic.
The inside stories on the teams, suppliers and drivers. This is Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
So we've popped outside now after my stunning debut in that Formula One simulator. Clive is still with me here at Cranfield on one of our midweek motorsport days out. How important is it, Clive, that in terms of the educational side of what Cranfield does, to have these really, you know, state-of-the-art, industry-leading commercial operations as well? And there's clearly a lot of crossover between one and the other.
Yeah, I mean, it is critical. I mean, what we do here is we're actually looking at the appliance of science, if you like, and I don't wish to be a poet by saying that, but it's true that if you can actually get students who are at the postgraduate level exposed to hardware, what's out there actually in the marketplace or being developed critically for the marketplace, it actually really adds value to their learning experience. And what then happens is because they're exposed to it, they become familiar with it and they're able to actually use the systems and enhance those systems.
So I think that's the key. I think that is really one of the biggest things, because somebody once said to me, a very clever person once said to me, if you want to be successful in anything, look at the thing that you most admire and then make it better.
Yeah.
Now you can't do that if you're starting from a point of knowledge that hasn't had you experience that.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, where we've just been with the motion cueing, if you were to take somebody and they haven't had that experience before, they're going to come to it without really understanding. Now, if you've got the understanding how it works, it's, you know, like the old adage of knowing what's underneath the bonnet of a car, you can actually get so much more out of it. So that is a critical aspect of what we're trying to do here in terms of developing the next generation of race engineers, of designers working in motorsport, etc. We're actually giving them access to the real kit, so they can go and work in wind tunnels, they can go and work in our composites lab, they actually get to make things in the composites lab, they can come over here, they can actually try out the simulator, they can work on modelling of vehicles for the simulator, and we can do that where the thesis project is concerned. And we actually have a lot of organisations supporting our thesis projects. I mean, I went to Brackley about a month or so ago, and we have...
I can't imagine who you're going to see there.
We have about 8 thesis projects on offer.
Really?
Yeah.
Right, what's next on the agenda?
Well, I've actually got to go and see some students regarding their MSc thesis projects.
See, proof that work is going on, even when I'm here.
But Paul's going to take you up to Building 54. We've got some very interesting equipment up there and some toys. There is an F1 car up there. But we've got a system up there which is called ORES, which is an off-road environmental simulation unit. Now, it's not fully commissioned yet, but what you were talking about where Audi are concerned, we've actually got something whereby you could put your car onto that system using our articulation rig and put the GQing in, etc., and you could run 24 hours of Le Mans there.
Right, I'm into that. Okay, I'll let you go and do some work, Clive, for the moment. Thanks very much indeed. We continue with our behind-the-scenes tour of Cranfield here on RadioLeMans.com.
This is Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
Well, I've come across to the far side of the facility now, right next to the runway on the, as you can probably hear, still active airfield here at Cranfield, to Area 51. No, no, it's Building 54 that I've been allowed into. Simon Stranks is with me now. I'm told it is almost as difficult to get in here as it is to Area 51. Is this the Skunk Works? What goes on here?
We deal with a lot of prototype vehicles for off-road vehicles and development.
And is that for OEMs, for original equipment manufacturers, is it?
Yes, that's correct, yes. We look at testing the vehicles in the whole vehicle on sand and soil. The sand is to the same specification that you would find in the Arab Emirates, and the soil...
Hang on a minute. You have specially specified sand?
That's correct, yes. It has the same grain size and particle size distribution as the sand you would find in the Arab Emirates, but it comes from a place in Bedfordshire.
Okay, I'm not even going to... I mean, you've obviously gone out and measured that. I'll take your word for it. Well, by its very nature then, quite a lot of what you're doing has to be kept completely confidential. How does that fit in with the postgrads and the learning side of things that's going on here at Cranfield, and how are you able to integrate what you're doing here into some of the theses that are going on?
That feeds our knowledge, and we're able to feed that on to the students. We're continually learning about vehicle performance, how vehicles react when they go on off-road surfaces, and we're able to use that to help the students learn about things like that.
I'm finding out more and more with different places I go to around the facility the importance of real-world applications of the technology and commercial applications of the technology that people are involved with here, and that seems to be a thread that's running through Cranfield itself.
Yes, the university is very proud of its association with industry, and that feeds on to our students and hopefully makes them more employable.
Now, looking here, there's something that I absolutely, off to our left here, recognise behind the yellow post. That's a rolling road, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Nothing drastically secret about that, then.
No, nothing drastically secret at all. We had a student working on a prototype lorry transmission, and we got that in specially for him to do that. But we use that in our motorsport master's course to demonstrate the power of vehicles and the torque backup, etc.
And right next to it, in fact, actually is a Reynard Formula Ford. Now, how old's that?
It's actually a Van Diemen.
Ah, you see? I said it was a Van Diemen, and Paul talked me out of that before. I said that was a Van Diemen. Is that an RF83 by any chance?
Yes, it's a 92, yes.
Yeah,
that's right.
There you go.
We were able to invest in that one year, a few years ago, and it's run every year in the Walter Hayes Trophy.
Fantastic event, by the way. If you've never been to it, Silverstone, back end of the season. It's one of the things that Jeremy Shaw's Team USA guys come across to do, because it is just a wonderful, wonderful celebration of the older Formula Ford cars. A big lift, a very big lift indeed. I've seen engine hoists in my time, but nothing quite like that.
Yes, that's an overhead gantry. It's been installed up here to help with the off-road environment simulator when that's fully commissioned.
Right, tell me a little bit about that, and where's that then?
That is those pale yellow frames with the big electric motors on.
Right.
Each one of those motors will be connected via a long drive shaft to a vehicle. And we will then be able to control, using that big bank of cabinets along the wall, which is about 5 metres long.
Presumably what's inside the cabinets is doing the clever bit.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Can we have a wander over to have a look at one of these motors? Because it kind of caught my eye as I came in. I'll try not to trip over it. And I've got a cart under here as well. So these motors then, you would collect what to each axle of a vehicle, would you?
That's correct, yes. And then via a computer, we'll control the load and the amount of torque and the speed. And we can measure the torque through torque transducing cells, and drive a vehicle inside a building as though it was being driven over a, for example, if it was going up a grassy slope. We know through work that we've done on the whole vehicle how the car performs going up a slope. So
you'd give it more torque or less torque if it was slippy, and make the engine, the transmission, the diffs work harder or less hard at each corner, of course.
That's right, yes. So we can, let's say you're going along the flat grass and then you start to go up an incline of, say, 20 degrees. Mm-hmm. We can drive, obviously you're going forward, so the front wheels will hit the slope first.
Yes.
Then the back wheels will probably have to put more power through them to push the car up, and then as you go up the traction becomes less.
Yes.
So we can simulate that, and we can repeat it lots and lots of times.
Identically, that's the thing.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Okay, got that. It doesn't rattle the car around though, presumably?
No, it doesn't. That's something that we're hoping to develop later on.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No, I'm not. We have an articulation rig, which is those four blue pads in the silver floor. They, at the moment, are on single-acting rams, so they can only go up,
yeah.
But they use the weight of the car to come down. Eventually, the plan is to replace those single-acting rams with double-acting rams, so we will be able to move the car and simulate going over rocks and actually move the car as it goes up the hill.
They say that's just too clever. So anybody, any budding Dakar rally fans who want to come and try out their new super duper suspension system, this will be the place to come.
Yes, but I couldn't tell you when it will be the place to come. It's still in its early stages at the moment. I mean, it's probably going to be 18 months before it's fully commissioned.
And the hardware and the software is being developed and designed right here?
Yes, the hardware is off the peg stuff. We've employed a company to install it. The software...
To your specifications, presumably?
Oh, of course, yes. The computer software will be written by one of our research fellows.
Do you see a time not so far in the future when the majority of testing of new vehicles, be it on-road or off-road, in terms of things like NVH, noise, vibration and harshness, which we hear OEMs talking about all the time, is that coming closer and closer to being done in a facility like this rather than having to go out and drive over cobblestones and then different surfaces on the test track?
Yes, particularly in the early stages of development when it's very expensive to build several cars because you want it repeated. And once the car becomes almost at the stage where it's going onto the manufacturing line, then I think the necessity to go out into the field and do real life shakedown testing will still be there, but the environment simulator will help them develop powertrains and shock systems and
From me, I think the advantage of it is the repeatability, of course, isn't it? And you can effectively run over the same surface over and over again on a test track, but the wind might be blowing a different direction, the ambient temperature might be different. The driver, however good he is, might be 2 inches to one side one time, 3 inches to the other side the other. And you're taking all that out of the equation.
Exactly. And if you think of using grass, for example, every time you run over it, the properties of the grass have changed.
That's a good point.
And also on sand, the properties have changed. Yes. You drive over it once, the sand has firmed down, become more compact. The next time you drive over it, you're going to get more traction.
Yes, exactly. I mean, effectively like driving in someone's wheel tracks. You haven't got someone like in golf with a bunker rake coming around and changing it back. And even if they were, you can't guarantee it was exactly the way it was when you went over 20 minutes ago.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly that.
I'm stunned by that. And it's actually, it's like all great ideas. It's actually a very simple idea to produce the repeatability in a controlled environment. Now, putting it into practice requires a hell of a lot of ingenuity and machinery. How long has this project been in the making, Sam?
I believe we've been thinking about it for probably 3 years. The installation of the equipment and the design of all the infrastructure has taken about 18 months to get to where we are at the moment.
And it's not a large building here. It's big enough for one car at a time. But I suppose for the short term at least, that gives you a starting point.
Absolutely, yes. And we prefer not to have to have several manufacturers in at once because of confidentiality.
Yes, okay. Again, though, got to stress, the for me, I think the cleverness is one thing, but also the integration into the other programs that you're doing here that gives that real-world environment for people to be learning in, to be writing their thesis on, and getting involved with the industry. And quite frankly, that's been a central tenet, hasn't it, of Cranfield from the very beginning?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Haven't relied heavily on commercial companies but it influences our research and it drives our master's programs forward and keeps them up to date.
The inside stories on the teams, suppliers and drivers. This is Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
Do you get feedback though from the manufacturers that you're working with in terms of, hey, that was great, you've really helped us out there, that was something we couldn't have done, now can you do XYZ? And I mean, it would be the sort of stuff that, you know, if they're thinking, well, we can't do it, they must think it's really blue sky thinking if they're going to throw it your way.
Absolutely, yes. And that's led us to develop another piece of equipment. We're doing whole vehicle testing on the sand, and that's fine, but you still got the looking at comparing different tyres. Mm-hmm. That's fine, but what's going on in the transmission system of the vehicle? You know, they're becoming more electronic. That takes over the management of the the transmission system. Mm-hmm. We wanted to then isolate the tyre completely and look at how that performs. And outside the building, you'll see a big green and white tractor with
yes.
a blue thing on the front.
It's a very big green and white tractor.
It is.
In fact, it's more like the sort of size of a combine harvester type thing.
It is, yes. But it's actually a tractor. And we developed what we've called the single wheel tester. So we can stick on the front of it a single wheel and then test different parameters, look at the amount of sinkage.
So that on the front of there, that blue thing, can we just nip around a second and we'll walk round? So that blue attachment on the front of there is effectively a test rig that you can put on. This is great. This is proper. Oh, look at that. Yes. All right. I see. So this big blue thing on the front, and what we're looking at here is a class vehicle, CLAAS, and they make large tractors and combine harvesters. If you think of a cab of a combine harvester, except about half as big again, and then instead of having the combine unit on the back and the tiny little wheels, it's got another set of big wheels on the back of that. That is a seriously big, and I've no doubt expensive piece of kit just on its own. And then on the front of it is a very heavy duty piece of metalwork and engineering that's been put on the hydraulics on the front with an arm there. And what do we normally see on the end of this arm?
We've got two hydraulic motors driving a gearbox which drives a shaft. Now we can control the speed of the wheel at the end of the shaft, and we usually do that by comparing it to the forward speed of the vehicle and saying we want to go at 20% slip.
Yes.
So the vehicle's moving forward at 4 kph. Mm-hmm. The wheel on that we're testing is going at 20 kph, 4 kph plus 20%
yep.
slip.
Got you. And then you're measuring what from that?
We're using the load cells integrated into it to measure the forces on the wheel in three different directions. We're also measuring the sinkage using a laser sensor, and we can calculate net thrust. We can draw the pull-slip curve of the wheel, and we can actually measure those forces to a greater degree that we can tell the difference between tyre treads on different same manufacturer's tyres.
Really? So this is, and I presume you can replicate, again, repetition, tremendously important under controlled surfaces. You could change the weight of the virtual vehicle that was sitting on that wheel, change it from a front wheel to a back wheel, potentially decide how much of the weight of the vehicle it was taking.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we can control the load within 0.01 of a kilonewton.
That's pretty cool. Can I just have a look around there? Because I am actually really... Oh, yes, now you see what we've got here is what you'd recognise as a drive shaft coming out with a couple of CV joints on it. And then this end here, where the rope's holding it up at the moment, the very technical bit of blue rope. I like to see real world solutions for that, though. That's great. On the end of that, that's where you would bolt the wheel and tyre.
Yeah, there's a hub which we have on the end, which I'm just repairing at the moment. Mm. That sits onto there with two extended octagonal ring transducers, which measure the force is both forward and backwards and side to side. And then the wheel sits on that hub, which spins and drives the wheel.
Yeah, so it is a driven wheel. That's the key thing. It's not just being pushed along. It's being driven at a speed that can have variance with the forward or reverse motion of the tractor that sits behind it. What I don't ask this, and you might not want to answer, but how much is that lot worth? Roughly speaking, not down to the penny. I'm not, you know, the VAT man's not listening, so you're all right.
I think in total it's about getting on for between half a million and £1 million worth.
Hmm. Yeah. We're not doing things by halves here, are we?
No, we aren't.
The kind of research that you're doing there is being fed back to whom?
OEMs and both for vehicle manufacturers and also tyre manufacturers.
Right, so they're getting the benefit of it. Daft question, but why aren't the tyre manufacturers and the OEMs doing something like this themselves?
Because of the investment in the equipment, the amount of time that they need to use it mm-hmm. is pretty minimal mm-hmm. compared with them developing a car. Mm-hmm. And we've got the facilities. We have the technical expertise.
So this is like pick ear manufacturer, they don't necessarily manufacture every bit of the car. They contract out the small widget or sometimes the larger widget to somebody who just does small or large widgets. You're doing the field testing and the developing of data because that's what you do.
Exactly, yes, yeah.
And you've got a very good reputation for it. Anything else you need to tell us about that, you know, is a bit secret? Come on, come on. I want an exclusive. I want an exclusive.
We don't have much that's secret at the moment, unfortunately for you. We have a GMC big white truck next door.
Which can we have a look at that?
Yes.
Come on, that's how you say. I like this. I like open access. The great thing about being on radio and the thing that... people forget about being on radio is we can walk through all kinds of places and people point at stuff and say you can't talk about that, whereas if you had a camera, of course, you would have already seen it. Oh, I see what you mean about the sand. This is what we were talking about earlier. We've just come into the world's biggest sand pit. How much sand in here and how deep does that go?
The dimensions of the bin are 5 metres wide. I've got about 20 metres length of sand and it's 750 mil deep.
Yeah, that's that. Right, okay, fine.
Just to put it into context, the other week I had 20 tonnes of sand delivered and it filled in about 4 metres of the bin. So there's,
right.
So there's 200 tonnes of sand in here.
Right. And I, what I should say, dear listener, is we are completely enclosed. There's a big roller shutter door behind us. So rain, hail, snow or wind would not affect what was going in here. At the moment, there's a more normal-sized agricultural tractor with a rake unit, like a disc harrow without the discs on it. Just got tines on the back of it, which has clearly been just raking the sand over. What's the big blue machine on the far end, sorry?
That's our soil processor. It was designed on the same principles as our small one in the other part of the building. It has a roller, a blade, tines and some discs, and we use that to process the soil. Once the tractor-mounted implement has been pulled through to loosen the soil, we use the blade then to level it off so we have a completely level surface for testing each time.
Right, let me just... I just need to find out and be able to tell you that... Yeah, so you hear that? That's the UAE in Bedfordshire, right? Okay. And I can tell you that is exactly like the UAE because we were there for the Dunlop Dubai 24 hours and I can... that. Feel of that sand on my fingers there. You've got that spot on, absolutely spot on. This is it. How long is this building? It's got to be about 80 metres, is it?
It's about 50 or 60 metres.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. This is a big facility. And again, what we're talking about here, dear listener, is investment to a pretty high standard and a high amount of financial investment. The sand stops. And this fantastically, I mean, this must have been, this vehicle that we're looking at now that you were talking about that rakes and blades the soil and or the sand, this has got to be custom built.
It was, yes.
It's like something out of Thunderbirds. We've got a normal tractor cab unit and where the rear wheels of the tractor would be, there's nothing there. There's not even any wheel arches. You've got the exit from the transmission coming down at about a 35, 40 degree angle. The drive shafts into a wheel that are mounted on huge blue girder outriggers. And then the rest of the machine is behind that. So effectively, no front wheels. The back wheels become the front wheels and drive it. It's only going up and down front wheels and backwards. That's okay, I understand that. And it's pulling this huge disc and tine that you heard Simon talking about a moment ago with the roller. The sand has stopped, and then we've got earth on this side.
Yes, that's right. Part of our testing of vehicles and tyres is also we want to go to the other extreme of looking at mud, mm-hmm. basically. That soil is a sandy loam soil, which is fairly nice and workable. It doesn't get really sticky if it gets wet. We can control the amount of water in the soil to within 2% over the whole area. And again, the area is about the same as the sand.
Yeah, so it's a big sand pit and a big soil pit. Think what we're looking at, dear listener. Think about a workshop pit. It's not as deep as that. It's, as you heard, it's about 750 750 rather than a full metre down. So it's not quite as deep as a pit, but it's wider than that. I mean, you could lose a car. In fact, I've driven cars that you could lose in that. And this sandy loam is just sitting there. And what? You can't just clearly run a hose pipe over that to get it wet. That's not scientific enough.
That's what we do.
Really?
Yes.
So how do you know, what did you use to measure the viscosity and the dampness content, the water content of the soil?
We know the soil properties because we've worked with this soil for a long time.
Again, here we're back to control and repeatability.
Exactly. We also, we have a meter that will tell us the volumetric water content of the soil by sticking six prongs into the ground, and when I'm using the soil, I put a grid onto it in my head and plotted it every meter.
Yes.
So I know the whole of the, and then the whole of readings across the whole of the soil surface, and then I go to a computer and draw a pretty graph, and that will tell me within 2% within 1%, but I aim to get it within 2% over the whole area.
So both of these two test areas, both for the soil and the sand, you would use those with real vehicles, with the test rig that we saw outside on the class as well?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Okay, cool. Now, I've spotted the truck. Which way is the easiest? Can we go across the soil? I won't ruin you.
No.
Oh, I was expecting to sink much more into that. That's actually, this is like the old thing where you see the guys on the moon, where you only go down about, an eighth of, no, maybe more than that, quarter of an inch. I've sunk down into that by 17 stone. But you see, that was nowhere near technical enough for Simon. I could tell that.
Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
Here at Cranfield. Simon Stranks is with me now. I recognise this because I do a bit of work in the States. I recognise this as a tractor unit with a sleeper cab that would normally pull a 40-foot Artic unit.
That's right. That is exactly what we have. However, it's slightly different to that because we were asked to do some work by the aerospace industry on what would happen to tyres if they landed on a runway at different angles.
Right.
They wanted to know the forces that were going through the axles and therefore going through the undercarriage.
So aircraft tyres coming into contact with, in landing situations, coming into contact at different angles, yeah?
That's correct.
Right.
Yes. So this vehicle will normally do about 55 miles an hour.
Yeah.
This particular vehicle will do up to 100 miles an hour.
Hello. Our listeners are already sitting up and taking notice.
Because we have a reduction gearbox in reverse behind the main gearbox.
Right.
So that speeds it up.
Right, got you. So down here is the business end of it, where you'd normally have the fifth wheel over the twin rear wheels. Mounted behind that is, again, what looks to be an absolutely custom-built rig sitting behind here. One thing I will say for everything I've seen already, the standard of workmanship on all of these bits of kit that you've got, which were, I presume, built here.
Yes, built and designed here.
Mm-hmm. So this is the business end. We get this up to 100 miles an hour on, presumably on the runway outside. We're not doing that down the A1, are we?
We're not doing it down the A1, but we actually go to the Millbrook Proving Ground.
Oh, really?
And use their high-speed bowl.
Oh, really? This on the high-speed ball at 100 miles an hour?
Yes.
See, I've been on there in an Audi R8 at nearly 200 miles an hour, and that scared the living whatnots out of me. However, I still think it would be more scary in this at 100 miles an hour. Now, the thing about aircraft wheels, of course, coming into contact with the road is, coming into contact with the runway when they do is, they have to spin up very quickly, because normally they're not spinning, are they, when they come down? They're not a driven wheel.
That's quite correct. So this rig has two axles, which have an electric motor attached to them so we can adjust the angle of them.
Mm-hmm.
They're held up with an air spring, so the vehicle gets up to speed, and then at a given point when all the instrumentation and data logging systems are running, the button is pressed, the air spring is released, allowing the wheels to come into contact with the ground, and we measure the force on impact and obviously the bounce that you get through
Good
the wheels
point. Yes.
until they're become a steady state situation, then the wheels are pulled back up off the ground,
yep,
and it's all repeated again.
And again, it's that repeatability thing,
exactly,
isn't it? Yeah, I'm going to just have a quick look around the other side. I would say, by the way, the truck is road registered, so it obviously drives up to the proving ground on its own. That is very, very clever, and what a great use of a big old truck. Not the sort of thing that you would normally find. Why did you find this truck? Is there a bit of a story behind it, or was it just happened to be hanging around?
It needed to have a long wheelbase. A UK tractor unit has a much shorter wheelbase.
Yes.
And to withstand the side forces and the skipping around, we wanted to have a long wheelbase and also a load area where we can put a frame on the back, mm-hmm, and load it up to about 5 tonnes.
Ah, yes, because that's the other thing I should have mentioned. Where the fifth wheel normally would have been, there's a nice flat tread plate area there, which at the moment is carrying what appears to be a ridiculous amount of very small spare wheels for the truck, the aircraft tyres, at least some of them are. I can see that from here. That would be where you would put the weights to simulate to give it a little bit more oomph on landing, effectively.
Exactly, exactly. We'd load it up so that the contact load on the tyres is the same as the aircraft would experience.
I'm absolutely stunned by this. Nice, though, that here's a building where we're seeing all the history of Cranfield, the aeronautics and the motoring side of things come together in one unit.
Absolutely. That's, again, the beauty of working at Cranfield. We can call on people's expertise from different departments, different groups.
Mm. Do you ever get bored about coming to work? Is there a day when you think, I might not pop in today?
No.
No, I'm not surprised. Simon, thank you very much indeed for showing me around a really, really fascinating part of what Cranfield's doing. I know this is tucked away at the back, and I'm sure not many people get out of here. So thank you very much indeed for opening the doors up and letting me and therefore our listeners have a look around.
You're most welcome.
RadioLeMans.com. This is Inside.
You can't help but be impressed with so many aspects of what's going on here at Cranfield. First of all, it's almost like walking onto a movie set in some aspects, because you've got a lovely mix of very obviously ex-RAF, ex-World War II era buildings, and then the most amazing glass houses. The library is a very modern Norman Foster building, and you just get the feeling, in the best British tradition, I have to say, that behind some of these windows, there are very clever people doing very clever things that we might not hear about for some time, if at all. Part of the reason I'm here today is because one of the Midweek Motorsport Collective said it would be a great idea to come here, and that's Paul Davis, and he's with me now, and he's helped set this up. So first of all, thank you very much, Paul. Now, you're going to have to lead on here, because I'm already completely lost. We're going that way, aren't we? Yes. You're a student here. The whole of this campus is post-grad. That's one thing that we sort of touched on earlier on, but we haven't really made the point of. So how have you come here, and what influenced your decision to come here? And in fact, what was your background in terms of your study and your qualifications before you came here?
Yeah, okay. Well, firstly, I'd like to say it's a pleasure to be on the other end of some of your programming for us. but I did my undergraduate degree out of school, knowing I wanted to go into engineering, and specifically motorsport. So then I did my undergraduate mechanical engineering degree. I then researched, when I was finishing that, I researched where was the next place to go to get into motorsport, which I knew I wanted to do. And then Cranfield came up. And then, as you can see why I wanted to come here from everything we've seen.
Yeah, you came on an experience day or a visit day, did you?
Yeah, I came on an open day, and we saw everything we've seen today, effectively.
And immediately then you went, yeah, I absolutely have to come here. I don't know what it's going to take, but I need to be here.
Exactly that, yeah. Yeah, so then I got what I needed to get here, and here I am, and I'm loving it so far. I'm about halfway through now. So.
Now, your background is what, and your previous qualification was what?
Mechanical engineering.
Right, so that gives you a basic grounding in what it says on the tin, mechanical engineering, because I can't even say it, never mind sit the exam.
Yeah, mech eng, it's
yeah.
Easier.
So that's what in broad terms?
Well, it's sort of largely road transport, mm-hmm. But you will touch on aerospace and sort of stationary structures as well. It's probably the most broad of the engineering disciplines, and because you can go into anything vehicular that isn't aircraft, effectively, okay. Therein.
Let's keep going back this way. So you came here, you saw, you desired of the place quite clearly, and why not when you're looking at that building in front of us, beautiful brick-built building, which is somewhat of the era I was talking about earlier, that being around the sort of World War II and just after era. Honestly, this is just fantastic. It does actually remind me a bit of Pinewood, and I have been there before. You get the same sort of idea that there's all sorts of stuff going on in these hangars and other buildings. So the course that you are on now is what?
The official title is Motorsport Engineering and Management MSc, but we just tend to call it Motorsport Engineering.
Right, and that's part of what campus here, if you like?
Oh, there are four schools, yeah. And the school we're a part of is Applied Sciences. Mm-hmm. The others are engineering, which is the aerospace, which is where the place was founded, and then there's a more medical focused area, and the management, which is also quite famous as well. And then within that course, we do all the relevant motorsport modules that you'd choose to touch on, so composites, aerodynamics, CFD, FEA, and then my personal preference of the race engineering sort of side of things, so vehicle dynamics, data acquisition, data analysis, using all the MoTeC and Pi software and that sort of thing. And then we have a group project, which we're doing now, just coming towards the end of, which we have to do design what is titled Club ERS, mm-hmm. rather cleverly. Mm-hmm. So that's engineering recovery systems for the club motorsport market, specifically Mica's Formula Ford. So we've got to do an innovative energy recovery system for a Formula Ford, and we can't sell it for more than £12,000.
Wow. So within that then, so that's actually quite clever, because that's a project where there's innovation, there's design, there's a proper application for it, which is clearly defined, and there's an element there of real world in that it's got to be produced for that figure. That's quite interesting.
Yeah.
What's the hardest bit being? Getting it down at the right price?
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, we also have to look at the business and marketing side of things as well. So we've got to turn it into a feasible business and you know, looking at a route to market and that sort of thing. So it's a big challenge.
I've made mention, and you've been around when we've been doing these interviews, I've made mention of the fact that the thing that strikes me at every turn here, and certainly with everybody that I talk to, is the connections with industry, with the real world, if you like. And in some cases, as we've seen in a couple of the places we've been today, the fact that they are run as real businesses parallel to the educational facility and sharing their knowledge base with that, but actually existing in the real world. It's a really cool place to be here, but clearly that must have had an impact and some influence on you deciding to come here because of that reality of being in a facility that, yes, is educational, yes, in some cases are theoretical, but we are doing that feature function benefit that I talked about earlier on.
Yeah, I mean, it's great fun to be here, and the links with industry are one of the most beneficial factors, certainly. And I've met so many motorsport luminaries that I've been reading about since I was a young boy, you know, Chris Eilert, Phil Barker, all these people that you mention all the time. Mm. And then to get their feedback, and they're saying, look, some students are lacking the more applied, practical, physical elements, the great technologically and mathematically thinking, but they're lacking in practical skills. And then here, whilst we touch on the technology and the academic side of things as well, we're also doing hands-on stuff, which is great fun. So we've been making carbon fibre wings in the composite centre from scratch, which is great. In the off-road dynamic centre where we've just been, in building 54, we did some tyre testing. Firstly, we did some Formula Ford tyre testing, looking at slip angle and the forces on the tyre, all that sort of thing. And then that data that we actually gained in that experiment is actually going to be published.
Oh.
Such was the newness of the data that we found, yeah. So that's quite cool.
Ooh, that's very cool indeed. The other thing about this is, you know, obviously you've been part of the collective. We see your posts on RidgeLeMond.com and on the Facebook pages on a regular basis. It does seem as though the industry is prepared to help. When I say the industry, I mean the motorsport industry in particular, but the automotive industry as well, is prepared to get involved here as well. Not to the extent where they are meddling, and I think that's an important point to make, but to suggest the areas that maybe need to be looked at, and this is where innovation might be coming in the next few years. Can we have a look at that, guys? And also, on a practical level, send some really great speakers down, because hardly a week goes by without you saying, oh, Ross Brown was here last week, oh, Adrian Newey's here next week, I'm having a cup of tea with whoever. I mean, that again must be a great spur for all of the students being here to hear some of those, many of whom, of course, are former alumni of this place.
Precisely, yeah. I mean, one such alumnus is Pat Simmons. Mm. You know, we had a lecture on tyrodynamics from Pat Simmons. I mean, where else can you get that? I mean, a man with the history of him, and he just comes down and speaks to us about tyres, and that's great.
I feel, I mean, I've spent probably more time than I expected to here already, and yet I've barely scratched the surface of what we've got, and I've seen two of the parallel businesses, if you like, of what's going on alongside the educational facility here. You've already talked about the composite area, and you know that's somewhere that we haven't even been into yet. But in terms of how you are being fitted for future employment, and whilst I don't disagree with education for education's sake, it's clearly far better and more useful if it can be put to a practical use. That comes back to the feature function benefit, actually, that we were talking about earlier on. Do you feel as though you're being put in a better position to go and take up a place in the industry of your choice, which would be motorsport, I presume?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think so. That's the case. I certainly feel that's the case from what I'm doing, what I'm learning, what the skills I'm gaining. Employers would seem to agree with that, given the people that have come on this course and are now doing great things in motorsport. So, yeah.
And what's the next step for you in terms of your study here?
Well, like I said, I'm currently looking at my group project, which is coming to an end in a few weeks. Then I start my thesis, and that will take me from April through to September. Mm. So no summer holiday for me, although I am going to Le Mans, of course.
Of course. Yeah, we'd mark you down. I'm sure Clive would mark you down if you didn't go to Le Mans.
Absolutely. So then I'm sort of looking at jobs now, and then there's the more traditional graduate scheme, mm-hmm. Where they sort of send you around all sorts of different areas, and then there's also the smaller companies, as there are so many of in motorsport.
You're in the carbon fibre triangle right here, aren't you? This is Motorsport Central.
Precisely. So through the connections that we make during the course, you know, we get to know them on a professional networking level as well as an educational level, and then
placements and things like that.
Some theses can involve placements, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm making a phone call to Mike Pilbeam after I finish this, well, to talk about my thesis. So,
Are we allowed to talk about what your thesis is going to be on?
Yeah, I'm hoping to do it on the trend of extra wide front tyres in P1 at the moment.
Ooh, okay. That might be over now, do you know that?
I know, finishing in 2014.
See, he's even across the latest rules or potential rules. Paul, thanks for setting this up. We're heading back down to have a quick final word with Clive before we leave, but thank you very much for suggesting this.
The inside stories on the teams, suppliers and drivers. This is Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
Well, what a day out this has been. One of, if not the most informative days out that we've ever done here on Midweek Motorsport. And certainly for me, I'm left just salivating at the prospect of I want to come back immediately. Clive, thanks very much for having us, and thanks to you and Paul for setting this up. I can't believe that anybody would come to this place and not want to be here more. I mean, do you have trouble pushing people out the door at the end of their time with you?
Well, the truth is, I don't really have too much of a difficulty, because invariably they go on to better things, insofar as they go on to jobs in motorsport primarily. We have a number of F1 teams come knocking on our door. They like what we produce, and off they go. We've got people already going to Brixworth, and we've got people going, I think, to Brackley, and down the road at Milton Keynes. But it's not just Formula 1.
That, by the way, would be Ilmore, Mercedes-Benz and Red Bull.
Not quite, no. It'll be the other part of Mercedes building the engines.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. But the truth is that we've got people also going into F3. We've got people going into World Series by Renault. We've got them going to lots of different destinations, but primarily in motorsport. So Some might want to stay on, and if we've got a PhD opportunity, yeah, we'll look at that. But the reality is, where motorsport's concerned, three-year time periods are really difficult to find a PhD opportunity. It's happened in the past. Danielle Casanova, who's the head of performance at Team Lotus F1, or whatever they're calling themselves this week. I call them Enstone Racing Association. He's got a PhD from this place, which he did, I think, with Benetton on the lap time simulation work. Pat Kelly, who's at Force India, he's another PhD from Cranfield. So, you know, that can happen.
The thing that I keep coming back to this, I've said it with everybody, and I'll say it with you as well, as we sort of pull all the disparate strands together here. I love the balance between the reality of what I'm seeing in terms of it being applicable in real life situations, the feedback from the motorsport industry, but quite clearly without any meddling. You know, the input that you're getting is of a very constructive nature, and the list of people who've gone through your doors in the last 15, 20 plus years is just extraordinary.
Yeah, that's true. And you're right to say that we've got that engagement with the motorsport sector. But no, they don't really meddle. What they do is they are actually very, very constructive. I mean, the support that we have from people like Alex Burns, Chris Aylett, from the MSA, Rob Jones in particular, is very, very positive. And at this moment in time, I've got meetings with students regarding their MSc thesis projects, which is a critical part of the course, because there we require them to do, you know, a lot of independent learning, but also to do a project that's actually going to have an outcome. And we really benefit from the engagement that we have with motorsport companies. I've just had one French guy in here who's actually going to be doing a race engineering type project with a satellite team to ARC Grand Prix. And we've got a relationship ongoing with ARC Grand Prix. And we get positive feedback. Not only do we benefit, but critically the student benefits, because they get exposed to real life situations. And I'm hoping, for example, that one of our students might end up perhaps helping out at Le Mans, for example.
Yeah, that would be cool. That would be very, very cool. And it seems to me as well that the type of projects that have been undertaken four theses here aren't pie in the sky stuff either. This is stuff that has applications, and presumably some of these have been published and have led to other things.
Oh yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, quite interestingly enough, we have a group project. That's the exercise that they're on at this present moment in time. It's 20% of the overall MSc course, but they have to work their nuts off for it. But I think it was 3 years ago we did that on LMP, and it was KERS. And so we're actually seeing that coming to life right now. I mean, we had Hope Racing last year, and now, of course, we've got Toyota, etc. You know, the interest in hybrids. And there's elements of work that we've done here that, either by accident or by design, actually gets out there into the real marketplace. And that's what makes it worthwhile, not just for tired old academics like myself, but critically for the students and the people they're working for. When Stefan came from Mercedes Grand Prix, he said that he wants to inject new blood into the company, particularly where the design side's concerned. And he really gets a buzz from working with young people who've got really good ideas. And that's what we need to do. We need to continue to stimulate this sort of engineering desire amongst young people. And I can't think of a better domain than motorsport.
I'm going to be possibly slightly controversial and not a little jingoistic here and say that when I was growing up, and probably slightly before I was growing up, the generation before me, Britain was known for its engineering excellence. It was known for its engineering innovation. We perhaps sometimes didn't develop and utilise it and certainly exploit it in the best ways, but we were known for innovation. Are we getting back to the stage now where research, development, bright ideas, challenging thinking, challenge everything, that type of thought, is that only now to be seen in places like Cranfield, and particularly with regard to motorsport, where there's an element of free thinking still allowed?
I think where motorsport's concerned, the engineers have got to work within the regulations, but the regulations themselves provide a really interesting engineering challenge. But what we are seeing is that where motorsport plays its part beyond motorsport itself, it's actually bringing to companies the DNA of motorsport. Yeah. So there's that opportunity where motorsport is very fast acting, both proactive and reactive. They can make things happen very, very quickly. And that's now starting to come across much more into the automotive domain. And so you're starting to see partnerships between people like Williams, for example, through Williams Hybrid, and Jaguar on their new supercar project. And what we're also seeing in this country is a real investment where automotive is concerned. So, you know, we've seen what's happening with Nissan, but I mentioned JLR, and Tata behind them are using the UK as its base to go and attack global markets. It's got excellent brands. We're very, very good at manufacturing. We've been through the tough times. We've made our manufacturing probably one of the, if not the best in the world, because we've gone beyond lean, in fact. But critically, we're about quality. And that's one of the things that you can find in the UK. There's a lot of quality. And again, when we come back to motorsport itself, reliability is critical. There's no point in building a 1,000 brake horsepower engine for it to blow up within 5 minutes. And we're very, very good at reliability. And, you know, it is interesting. Mercedes Grand Prix operation is in the UK. Its engines are built in the UK. And I can reflect that across the piece. You know, why are they coming to the UK? It's because we've got the environment in which people can thrive.
And talking of manufacturing, something that I learned last week was we think of the glory days of British car manufacturing particularly being somewhat over. Nissan at Sunderland built more cars from a single plant than have ever been built last year, ever, in the history of British manufacturing. So let's not think that British manufacturing is dead. Final question, and it's slightly frivolous, but not in other ways. Do you have to be interested in motorsport to work in motorsport and to get the best out of something like the courses that you're running? Or is the engineering challenge enough to bring people into it?
I think that it's, you know, the question of synergy, isn't it? It's symbiotic. If you've got the passion, then you're going to add real value. And to my mind, most of the good engineers that are out there are also passionate about what they do. They might not necessarily watch Formula One. They might probably watch MotoGP, for example. I know a lot of people who've done that in the past. But I think you've got to have really a genuine interest in the motorsport environment. It could be anything ranging from off-road motorsport to endurance racing, from bikes through to F1, but you've got to have that in your in your bloodstream.
Yeah, because it's a lifestyle choice if you're going to go and make a career in motorsport. It isn't a job.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a lifestyle choice. I mean, you can be working all the hours that you've got and more. And that's what, I think that's what also makes people want to do it, because they've got that passion for it. And I think that's why, dare I say, us Brits are pretty good at it, because we've got that sort of mentality to go through extremes to get results.
In educational terms, and certainly in British university terms, Cranfield is a baby. Despite the long list of achievements that it has, where do you see the facility in 20, 30, 40 years' time, and where in perhaps the more short to medium term, what will we see going on here that will be still pushing those boundaries? What will we see added?
Okay, where motorsport's concerned, I think that we will continue to develop both as a university and in relation to the sector that we serve. You know, we're in a very strong position geographically. We are recognised as being part of the UK motorsport cluster, which dominates the world. In terms of investment, the university continues to invest. Motorsport companies continue to come and work with us. We are developing new facilities. We've got a very extensive laboratory really dedicated to off-road, and we are working with both automotive and motorsport in that context. I see us doing more and more tyre-related work, both on the characterisation and modelling side. But interestingly, we've already been and visited the simulator, the race simulator that Cranfield Motorsport Simulation have developed with the GQing simulation. Now, what I'm seeing is up in Building 54, as we call it, we've got this new facility coming on stream there, and that's going to give us some real potential. I mean, you will actually be able to sit in your own LMP car, for example, and do a run of 24 hours at Le Mans. And I mean, that's going to be so fantastic.
In a real car.
In a real car. And we can put the GQing into it.
So that is taking, effectively, the best of simulation, the best of modelling from that side of things, whether it be visually, whether it be feedback for the driver through the control systems of the car, plus the most sophisticated sides of effectively a very, very clever shaker rig, and putting that all together and combining that into a real-world experience for the car and the driver combined.
For the car and the driver, but also, interestingly, for the engineer. You see, this is where we're going to next. It's okay putting a driver into a car and running sim, but if you can bring the engineer into the equation, then you're really going to get added value. And we're not just doing that in terms of the technology side, but we're also looking at research where we're engaging with both drivers and race engineers to look at the whole communication side, because the language of race engineering is critical. If you want to optimise both the driver and the car, the race engineer is a key component, but the race engineer has got to understand what the driver's saying, and the driver has to actually understand what the race engineer is communicating. So you've got to get the two working together, and communication is not just about talking, it's actually about listening.
I've done plenty of both today. Thank you very much indeed. It's been a real eye-opener, and I hope I can come back again in the not too distant future and find out more of what's going on here at Cranfield.
Well, you're more than welcome, John. I'd like to see you back.
Inside on RadioLeMans.com. This programme is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemans.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.